Okay. So let me just briefly remind you that what we were doing yesterday. We started looking at this funny classical field theory with vanishing coefficient. And in particular, the object we were looking at the end of yesterday is the fundamental string charge. Because of usual gauge invariance that comes with open string quantization, this field strength F on world volume always comes together with B mean U in the form of, where of course this means pullback of spacetime B mean U back to my world volume. And whatever generates fundamental string charge out of this world volume degrees of freedom has to be this combination, because that's what enters on the right-hand side for the equation of motion for Lubeck-Schwarz two-form field. And because of this, this is exactly the same as this guy, which is exactly the same as this guy, which is nothing but what we call conjugate momenta. So we are looking at how the dynamic, classical world volume dynamics goes of that conjugate momenta in the limit where potential goes to zero in such a way that we are actually sitting at the vacuum of this system. And that turns out to be extremely simple. It has just two pieces. It has square of flux, and it has square of physical momenta. Okay? And of course, there is a usual Gauss constraint you have to impose on your physical state in such a way the essentially static energy is simply given by absolute value of your flux, which means that there is no physical interaction between these flux lines because there is no pressure of this flux. So today, let me do a little bit more technical computation. Oh, by the way, tomorrow we are going to come back to this part and try to say something about things like domain walls, that is a lower dimensional DP mind, stable D branch that comes out of this system. Well, today let me concentrate on these fundamental string charges. Yes?
What happens to the magnetic field constitutions?
Oh, magnetic field is something funny. So this expression on world volume is in general something like this, and in particular in this two-dimensional case like this. So magnetic field in this context simply means there is a conjugate physical momenta. So magnetic field on its own doesn't do anything physically. So instead of doing this special case, let me go back to this general action in arbitrary dimension, okay, and do the analysis. It turns out analysis is more or less identical as in D2 case. And for this, let me remind you a very useful identity. Many of you already know this, but nevertheless, I'm so fond of this, so I'll repeat it anyway. There's this general formula in computing determinant. So let me divide my matrix, square matrix, into a form like this. So this is not the most general metric of matrix, but has a little bit special form in that this part is sort of anti-symmetric. Well, the theorem says this is equal to times determinant M plus A N inverse A transpose, equivalently determinant M determinant N plus A transpose M inverse A transpose. Okay. Well, in fact, what we really need is particularly simple case of this, where this is some matrix, and this is a column vector, row vector, and some number there, which means in this case we have determinant of determinant of N M plus VT N inverse V. Okay? I should have used the upper one, but so let me go with one here. So why is it useful? So if you look at the determinant up there, okay, it sort of has some structures like this here, okay? So if I write the following in, matrix, say G plus F mu nu, okay, and round mu xi round mu t minus and round mu xj round mu t delta ij 0, 0, 1 and take the determinant of that and split right here. Okay. Then this would be like n, like m, and this would be like a. So if you take the take this determinant and make use of this identity, the whole thing becomes determinant of, so I'm using, I guess, this part of identity. Then the whole thing becomes determinant of 1 times determinant of eta plus f plus round xi plus round t, okay? So this horrible determinant over there, in some sense, got a little bit simplified here. And you will realize this is nothing but a consequence of t-duality. And if you define an extended gauge sphere, say that not only having this a mu, but let me call ai, and just define it to be xi, and a, say, t, defined to be t, and partial derivative, and round I defined to be identically zero, and round t defined to be identically zero, okay? If you do this, then the expression, expression you see down there is nothing but eta mn plus f mn. Okay, so this matrix is nothing but this with this extended indices around. Okay, so having these extra things on the gradient of Scala is not going to complicate things too much for you, and you can do all the computation after pretending that those colors are actually some gauge field component. So that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so the action then can be written as V of t square root determinant eta plus f, where this is a larger matrix. But of course, integration is still over the world volume because that's only the physical part. Now, let me make use of the previous identity just one more time. So instead of splitting up things like that way, let me split it up slightly differently. So let me split up time part and the spatial part. So here is here is EI and EI, which means simply time derivative of XI, and ET, which is just time derivative of T. So this is XI dot. And then this should be anti-symmetric. So you have this, like this. And then I have a complicated mess, but these are spatial parts like this, okay? So then determinant of this again using the exactly same identity, you get, so let me actually call this whole thing H. Okay, then this would be H and minus 1 plus H inverse PQ EP EQ. Okay. So I'm just again making use of this identity. So let me erase that. Therefore, the Lagrangian, although this is still a mess, is slightly better than before. So special part of this matrix comes here, and part that involves time derivative simplifies a great deal. Okay? And of course, since these two are same guys, really only symmetric part of this H inverse contribute there. Okay. Well, once you have this, conjugate momenta, and of course, as I mentioned before, pi I, which is some part of this, is physical electric flux, which means it's fundamental string charge, is something pretty simple. So determinant of H remains there. This determinant goes down there. And I get H inverse symmetric P Q E Q. Okay. Therefore, the Hamiltonian defined to be dot minus L, okay, is up to Gauss's constraint, which just come out of a place where I convert this to electric field, or I should say E of P, is going to be given by the following expression. V square root of determinant of H H inverse PQ and EQ. Okay? So you get something very compact even though you have this messy expression in the beginning. Now, of course, again, the one crucial point about writing down the Hamiltonian is to write it in terms of canonical variable instead of electric field. So what you want to do is convert the whole thing and write it as a function of pi p and fij, fpq I should say. Okay? Now, in principle, this could be a lot of mess, because what you want to do is basically invert this in favor of E, okay, and plug in what E as a function of pi p is. But of course, if you know the, what the answer is, verifying it is always easy. And let me just give you the answer. And answer is not that different from the T2 case above. And the answer is, if I call this non-trivial part of Hamiltonian H naught, H naught simply equals pi p summed over p f p q pi q f p r pi r v square determinant of H. Okay? So in instead of showing it here, I'll just leave it an exercise. This will take you half page, basically. All you need to know is the following well-known identity. H is here essentially 1 plus F, because I'm using a flat metric. When I have a metric, something like some matrix like this, H inverse can always formally written as 1 minus F over 1 minus F, 1 plus F. This is a trick people have used when they discuss non-commutative field theory. And of course, once I write it this way, the symmetric part of this is just getting rid of this and keeping the symmetric part one here, which means this is like F transpose inverse of that. And once you use that, verifying this backward is extremely easy. So again, I have a dynamics where the Hamiltonian is in some square root form. Okay. And if I take a limit where I'm actually sitting at the vacuum far away, this is all there is. Okay? So let me try to make use of that and look at some special cases. One case I'd like to consider first is the case where I turn up, instead of the scalars, let me turn up everything except the tachyon up there. So gauge field turned up, the transverse scalar completely turned up, so it's just dynamics of tachyon. Which means of pi p, only pi t, the last component, is kept. There is no physical electric flux in this case. And of FPQ, only thing that is really left is round I of tachyon. Okay? Then what you have is H naught equals pi t squared, pi t round t squared, square rooted like this again. Okay? So again, this is like mass squared. As I mentioned this before, this is really physical momenta squared. And therefore, you have some expression where you have mass squared plus p squared, square rooted being equal to energy. And this is exactly what happens when you have a massive relativistic particle, which doesn't interact with each other. Okay? And thus, I mean, this was noticed by Ashok Sen last year, and he gave the name tachyon matter because it behaves like dust particle. But in fact, apart from, you know, having this formula that looks sort of like, you know, free massive particles in relativistic dynamics, you can actually do a little bit better than that, because you have a Hamiltonian, so you can write down actual equation of motion, just like in particle case. So if I do this, T dot is delta H delta pi T. And because the whole thing can be written as pi T in front of everything times square root 1 plus round I T squared, this is, as long as sine of pi t is kept to be, say, positive in some region locally, this is just basically plus minus 1 plus round I t square. Which means if I have a background where tachyon is homogeneous, the whole thing is 1. And therefore the name rolling tachyon, because tachyon evolves linearly in time. And I just want to show you that this result of rolling tachyon is nothing but consequence of one of the equation of motion. Then the physical content of this dynamics is in the other equation. Okay? And that you can write it as absolute value around IT. Okay. Well, it takes a little bit of experiment, but it is not difficult to discover that this combination, which is same thing as 1 plus round IT squared, is actually Lorentz invariant quantity. It's some sort of Lorentz invariant density. So if I call that rho, and observe the fact that something like pi t round I t was supposed to be physical momentum, and this is sort of like density of something, and what this must be is nothing but velocity of this thing. So let me call actually u mu like this, and if I express this equation of motion in terms of this and this, what we have is, let's see, if I do that, I guess I would have u of naught equal to ui squared and rho u naught round t is like round I rho ui. So this means is u mu is 1 minus 1, and rho u mu round mu is 0. And you will realize this is nothing but continuity equation. When there is a fluid of density rho, velocity field u, this simply says if fluid moves away, the density changes accordingly. There is no dynamics here. And in particular, if I multiply, what do I want to do? I'm a little confused here for the moment, but you can combine all of this together and basically find that the whole thing actually moves according to geodesic. Okay? So this is completely free fluid of dust that doesn't have any pressure, that doesn't have any interaction whatsoever. And in fact, some people were excited last year and tried to make cosmology out of it. I don't necessarily endorse that. All right, so that's kind of typical behavior in this system. Because pressure disappears out of dynamics, even though you think you are solving some classical field theory, the end result is as if you are doing some, you know, macroscopic fluid dynamics. Okay, any question up to this point? Yes?
The whole thing that makes this go is the fact that the key enters into this Lagrangian, just like a coordinate.
That's right.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. That's right. But on the other hand, the fact, for example, that there is this behavior, dust-like behavior without any pressure, I think is actually independent of that. I'm going to...
Well, it depends on the large key behavior, is that right?
That's right. I mean, what is important is that the potential there is runaway potential. So, for example, I couldn't have done any of this because you can see T dot is 1, which means I need to insist V equals 0 and still have T arbitrarily large value, which is impossible unless it is a runaway potential. So crucial thing there is really runaway potential. And the fact that there is no pressure is related to the fact that there is no propagating degrees of freedom in this dynamics. And if you take not that action, but for example, take this horrible reaction you get out of boundary string field theory. I mean, that doesn't look anything like that. It says several gamma functions upstairs, downstairs. But you can do sort of analysis whether there is dynamical degrees of freedom that can mediate force between components, between densities. Exactly the same conclusion shows up there. Although we haven't done any Hamiltonian dynamics of that, we are pretty sure that this effect is there as long as you have a runaway potential like that. Hopefully, I might be able to get to this discussion of domain world tomorrow. And one of the really nice thing about this particular kinetic term is if you reduce, or if you get low energy effective dynamics that governs this domain one, which is actually supposed to be stable BPS brain, the low energy dynamics, if you start there, is again Dirac-Bonin-Feld, exactly. And that sort of tells me something interesting is going on, although a priori that form of action doesn't really have string justification.
This other picture, which T really is a coordinate?
You mean physical coordinate?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is, for example, there is proposal by Ashok that says maybe T is time. You know about this? No, I'll talk about it tomorrow. That, I find that extremely amusing. Yes?
But this work even for dimension, the different, different of two, right?
Right, this is for any dimension that I did. So the P.
The D2, okay.
D2 case I did yesterday just because it's the simplest. So there are the indices I runs from G1 to P, and big I runs from, say, P plus 1 to whatever dimension space-time have, and you have extra P, which behave as if it is a coordinate of some kind.
You get pressure fluid when you follow the electric or the electromagnetic.
Pardon me?
When you follow the, you turn off with the electromagnetic.
Right. Yes, I mean, it's not going to follow this equation of motion. It will have a directional prejudice. So, for example, this says this distribution can be any function of any of the coordinate, arbitrary function of coordinate. Once you turn on the electric field, it turns out this cannot depend on the direction along which electric field is lined up. So there are some subtleties once you begin to mix this tachyon matter and string fluid. Yes, there are different characters, but it seems like there is sort of well-founded string interpretation of all of this state. Okay, and for that you want to go back and read one of the more recent paper by Ashok. Now let me actually go to the other limit where I get rid of scalars altogether. Xi's and T I'm going to turn off. So T will enter only through that potential, and I'm going to have just this electromagnetic field. Okay? So then Hamiltonian, again, it looks exactly the same as before. Nothing happens here, except I now is running from 1 through P. And Pi is Fij pi j by definition. Okay. Now, I mean, in principle, you can do everything with this. You can analyze all aspects of this dynamics without doing anything further, just writing the field equation of this, and it's been done, it's doable. But for this particular case, there is very, very pretty picture, classical field theory, where you can cook up another equivalent classical field theory that has exactly the same Hamiltonian. Okay? But it's not the same Lagrangian you started with. The initial Lagrangian is very strange because the whole thing vanishes on shell, and in fact not only potential vanishes, if you are going to have any physical degrees of freedom, the determinant part has to vanish as fast as the potential. And in fact that's what allows me to have this finite pi I. Okay? So in that sense, I mean, that although the two things are classically equivalent, I mean, variables there is in some sense rather inappropriate in this sector of phase space. So let me cook up a slightly different sort of description. So here we have two additional things going on other than the field equation you get out of this. One is Gauss constraint, and the other is Bianchi identity. Okay? Now, common thing we can try whenever you see a gauge theory like this is to swap the two and try to interpret this as a Gauss constraint and interpret this as a Bianchi something. And in case of familiar Maxwell theory, of course, this is achieved by inventing a dual field related to Hodge dual of another antisymmetric tensor field. But this is true. This is okay only if Lagrangian is like this, because Bianchi of dG would be d star f, and it better be equation of motion out of this. But this is equation of motion only if you have this linear type Lagrangian. So the thing to do is to go to, in general, go to this Hamiltonian formulation and just try to switch the two. Okay? Let's see, this becomes a little bit messy here. So as a dual Lagrangian, I'm going to do the following thing. So I have H naught, it's a function of these guys, and I'm going to impose a this Bianchi identity by introducing a Lagrange multiplier field. Okay, so J1, JP, P minus 3, DF, JP minus 2, to JP. So it's, the whole thing is linear in B. So it, integrating this out will impose that this would be 0, and that's with that I usually think of Bianchi. And then do the Legendre transformation like this. This should be 3 there. And F, P minus 1, J, JP, epsilon, da 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 da. So I'm doing Legendre transformation not with respect to this guy, but rather with respect to this guy. So I'm going to treat this as if it is a conjugate momenta of something. Now, at the end of the day, essentially the effect of this is to do the following thing. Like this, upon doing partial integration here, and calling this C naught J1 P minus 3. So, in effect, this so-called dual Lagrangian, it should be expressed as function of this tensor field C. It's just this Legendre transformation and do the variation with respect to F. Okay. So then you just go through and write down equation of motion for this and plug in, this will give you essentially DC of star given by something like this. Okay, so you just plug that in to the formula, and what you find is the whole thing is dc squared. Okay, of course I'm doing everything in the limit where potential is already taken to zero. So let me give you an exercise. derive energy momentum tensor. For theory of this kind. And you will find all but one component of pressure will vanish completely. Just write down the usual definition of the energy momentum tensor. Okay? In fact, the funny thing is, this sort of action was actually cooked up long, long time ago by Linson and Olson. And the motivation, primary motivation at the time was, I mean, this was 1973. So this is before people realized that there is graviton in string. And, but it's supposed to be effective theory of QCD, not QCD, they didn't know QCD, but dual string, the interaction that governs hadrons. And they wanted to write, they want to cook up something, some field theory that has string as an elementary object. And that's exactly the kind of action they wrote down at the time. Now, so if you write down the energy momentum tensor that comes out of effective action like this, okay, and write in terms of original physical variable, let me remind you, this was the fundamental string charge, and this was physical momentum. And then if you write down P mu nu in terms of those original variables, what you find is the following simple expression. Which, if I go to a frame, a local frame, local co-moving frame, where momentum tensor vanishes, or momentum vector vanishes, this locally can be expressed as pi I square, square rooted, 0, 0, 0, 0, minus pi I square, 0, 0, and 0 everywhere else. So what is it? So this is where my energy density sit in usually. So this is energy density as before. This is just absolute value of your flux density is your energy. What is this? This is a negative pressure, but along the direction of the flux string. But we have another name for negative pressure. It's called tension. So this is some sort of 1 plus 1 dimension object, which has energy density and tension, and the absolute value of energy density equals the tension. And the, we already know object like this, it should be some sort of relativistic string-like object, which does not interact with each other. And initially, I said we want to look at this charge, pi, which should carry fundamental string charge. And we found, at the end of the day, some object, fluid-like object, whose component is again something like string. But two are a little bit different because fundamental string should come in some quantized form. This is some continuum of infinitesimal string. Although the dynamics seems very similar, it's not clear whether this is fundamental string or not yet. So hopefully I'll have time to mention some proposal about that also later. Okay, so let me push this thing a little bit further. Okay. So energy density is such that as long as string is straight, this and widely dispersed configuration with same, say, 5 units of flux here and 5 units of flux here. It's cost exactly same energy. There is no preference. And therefore, it is a hugely degenerate system. Nevertheless, I could think of an ANSAT where all of these 5 units of flux goes straight and at the same position. There is nothing in the dynamics that prevent me from doing that. Okay. And then I could ask a little bit more, and let me sort of try to bend them. Again, same 5 units of flux lines going like this. Of course, it's not going to be static configuration. It will move around because there are tension along this, which means this string wants to become straight. But that's exactly what you would expect from tension for string anyway. The question is, what is the equation of motion of this configuration? Okay. Now, there are many different ways of deriving this equation of motion, but somewhat this is a little bit of cheating, but nevertheless it's useful. What we can do is look at, write down a configuration that corresponds to this and plug that in to this dual effective action and ask how equation of motion behave or how the reduced action behaves. Okay. And let's see, perhaps the right thing to do is to simplify to the case of D2 again. Okay, so I haven't written down the explicit relation between the two, so let me write that down actually. So the rule of mapping here between this new quantity C and original variables pi and f pi is actually the following. You write down this two form. And that's supposed to be dual of DC. So since this is two form, this is P minus one form. Okay? And in particular, in case of D2, C or DC should be one form, which means C is a really a scalar. And this is exactly the case I discussed at the end of yesterday's lecture. And in that case, effective Lagrangian, dual Lagrangian, is simply square root of d phi square when I call this scalar phi. Okay? So what is this object that carries, there is a fundamental string charge? Because of this relationship, okay, because I have this Hotze dual there, if I have a flux like this, this will have some localized density somewhere in space. Okay? And that on the other side has to be realized by a gradient of phi. Okay? So here the relationship is pi I is like epsilon ij round j phi. So if I have some flux that goes like this, and if I measure this field phi across this flux, this will jump by some appropriate amount of unit. Okay? So this is like sort of domain one. So you jump by delta phi across this physical flux, and that's the prescription. Okay? So, So the answer to write down is to make sure you have some delta phi to jump n hat being essentially this normal vector, normal to the flux lines, and delta, say, n hat, by which simply means if I do this integral across the flux line, this is 1. Okay? It's too far away. And then n hat, if I call this point in the brain and denote it by x mu sigma 0 and sigma 1, because sigma 0 and sigma 1 because it's like a string, okay, then n hat by construction should be orthogonal to x mu and also round 1 x mu, okay. And of course you might think this is completely singular configuration. You have a delta function in your gradient, and normally if you have a delta function in your gradient, it will cost infinite amount of energy, because energy usually comes in the form of something squared and integrated. Or for example, gradient of something squared and integrated, and delta square of delta function cannot be integrated, it's infinite. But in this case, this is okay because everything is square rooted. You have pi, for example, in the Hamiltonian, I mean, it's really that pi that has a delta function concentration somewhere. But you have delta function square, but you need to take a square root of that at some point. Then at the end of the day, you have really only one delta function. So although this looks extremely singular configuration, this is okay because neither the action nor the energy associated with it diverges, and it is actually finite. So you just plug this into action where C happens to be a scalar field and evaluate dx3 minus phi, okay, and after a bit of computation what you find is this integration of dx3 will disappear because you have delta functions like this, okay? But one way of writing this delta function is like introduce d0, d sigma, d1, and delta of 3, small x, large x, sigma, and some Jacobian factor associated with it. And Jacobian is given by things like this. So at the end of the day, what you find is this action completely reduced to another determinant loop kind of formula, which is nothing but determinant of your induced metric. Okay, you have this some string-like object in some background D2 brain. Okay, and depending on how it is embedded, there will be induced metric on it, and at the end of this computation, the effective action for this object is just taking determinant of that embedded metric, induced metric, and take a square root. And we know what this thing is. This is called Nambu-Goto action for relativistic string. So we went through this almost trivial classical field theory exercise and found something that resembles a fundamental string. So should we get very excited and say that we found a closed string out of open string three-level theory? But that's a very difficult thing to say because as we know in open string theory, closed strings appears in some very strange way. You begin to notice about closed string in open string theory only when you begin to include interactions and begin to look at one loop computation of one open string. For example, exchange of graviton far away has alternate interpretation as a one loop of open string amplitude. But here, we not only truncated everything down to tree level of open string, but we also truncated all the higher mode of open string and just kept massless mode and tachyonic mode. And we found something that resembles fundamental string. Okay? So this is a little bit strange situation, rather unusual situation as far as string theory goes. And now before closing, I should caution against taking this too seriously and try to basically give you an argument that says, I mean, although I found some object in this theory as a, in some subsector that behaves exactly like classical closed string, well, I guess I haven't said anything about closed string. Well, I just said do this, but of course there's nothing in here that prevents me from doing closed loop of flux line. So that's what I mean by closed string.
Why?
Well, I mean, I started with infinite something, infinite flux lines, okay, to argue that existence of such a thing, okay? But open string, at the end of the day, is supposed to disappear completely out of this story. And in fact, there is, I mean, in order to have open string, you need to have an endpoint somewhere. But in this theory, there is no charged object whatsoever. Even if you include all the higher towers of open string, there is no charged object here. So this cannot end on somewhere. It's either loop or infinite.
In that case, wouldn't you have to have some kind of vorticity term in the orthogonal positive dimension tensor?
I couldn't hear you.
Configurations like that, would you not need to have vorticity terms?
That's right. There could be some problem with electric field having some winding number associated with it. My viewpoint, I mean, I am not completely sure about this. There are two ways out of this. One is that winding number is there if you insist not turning on any of the scalar, in particular tachyon. If you turn on the tachyon, you can smooth it out by having some tachyon matter content around. Okay, that's one way out. Second way is to simply say that there is nothing fundamental about the initial gauge field configuration, and in particular E itself never enters in the dual effective dynamics. There are only momentum and the string enters. So it might be that original electric field itself is not physical anymore, and then we don't need to worry about possible topological defect associated with that. So, I mean, there is a way out, but I cannot say that it's airtight, okay? So there is some, as you say, there is extra subtlety with loop like this. Anyway, so we found some classical string that, yes? I'm sorry, I didn't. Oh, you mean, does it couple to beam in U?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I carried through this, okay? So this is what has delta function distribution. And I didn't do anything to this action. So if I kept beam in U up there, it will retain this coupling. So this will couple to beam in U in the ordinary way. Ordinary way, yes. And of course, there is some subtlety, important subtlety of, you know, what actually closed string coupling is, but I'm not going to worry about this at the moment. Anyway, this is classical Nambu-Goto string. And not all classical Nambu-Goto string is fundamental string, because fundamental string is actually something very special. We, of course, you know, have this, you know, elementary discussion about D must be 10 or 26. And that comes from the fact that you want to have theory with massless graviton. I mean, that's one of the constraints. I mean, there is a consistency in addition to that. But one thing, you know, that I need to you know, to identify this object as really closed string would be to have intercept, say, minus one or minus half. And since I haven't done any quantization here, and in fact, I don't know how to do quantization in this context, it's not clear whether I will have intercept minus one or minus half at all. So this may or may not have anything to do with fundamental string. In fact, there is an argument that says at this level, it cannot be fundamental string. And this goes, this is due to a couple of greatest minds of our age, and it's commonly known as Weinberg-Witten theorem. So this is something that came out early 80s and essentially put an end on what has been known as induced gravity. People tried to get gravity out of some Lorentz invariant field theory without diffeomorphism, because gravity is such a difficult thing to do by itself. And the theorem says the following two facts. Theorem one says, a theory that has Lorentz covariant conserved for vector j mu cannot contain massless particle of spin larger than half and couples to this. So there is no charged massless particle of spin larger than half if there is a Lorentz covariant current of some kind, conserved current of some kind. Theorem 2, if there is covariant theta mu nu, by which I mean energy momentum tensor, there cannot be massless particle of spin larger than 1 that has direct coupling to this covariant tensor. Okay? Well, of course, this assumes that theory is a field theory without any diffeomorphism invariance. This is not theory of gravity, for example, here. And as you recall, if you have a dynamical gravity, there is no well-defined local energy momentum tensor. There is an energy momentum tensor associated with the matter part, which is well-defined, but there is no energy momentum tensor of the whole system. Okay? So that's how Einstein's theory evades this theorem. Now, proof of this is actually extremely simple. So let me just within 1 minute outline it. So let me take this simple one and do this. So if there is charge, so P is momentum and J is helicity. This is a massless particle, so helicity is conserved. So if there's a coupling with some coupling charge or charge, it should go like this. Okay? And question is whether this coupling is zero or not. Now, I can look at this slightly differently, and instead of doing same momenta, let me put a different momenta here. Okay? And go to a Lorentz transformation in such a way that P prime is, say, if I write it as epsilon minus epsilon, where this is some vector, P like this, so that the momentum is opposite, okay? Then rotate this whole thing along direction of this momenta, say by some arbitrary angle, then this will transform. And you can do this in two different ways, either by rotating this wave packet or by rotating this vector thing. So by rotating this, you will get some usual vector rotation of the same thing. By rotating this, you will get ij theta, where this is again helicity, and twice, because one factor from here, one factor from here, and from the fact that they have same helicity but opposite momentum. Okay. Okay, so here's J. Now, what this thing is, since I'm just rotating a vector, only thing that can come in is things like exponential I theta 1, exponential minus I theta. Okay? However, for large J, for large helicity, this will have exponential of things like 2 I theta, which cannot possibly match up with this for arbitrary theta. Okay? So unless J is either half or zero, there is no way you can match up the two. And this means if it is, the whole thing is Lorentz invariant, has to be zero if J is larger than half. And exactly the same argument goes for energy momentum tensor case. So since we started with the field theory, completely Lorentz invariant field theory, and found this string-like object, and if there is a consistent way of quantizing this within this field theory, this theorem basically tells me that I'm not going to see any massless graviton, which seems to say that I'm not going to see any real fundamental string.
So I could just more than one particle.
Right, but I'm just looking at particular amplitude, and I'm just asking what is the charge, whether that particle couples to energy momentum tensor or this conserved momentum. And this says it cannot have a coupling, or, I mean, although this is some particle with energy, the energy momentum tensor cannot know about it.
It seems to me there's a lot of reason to think that you don't want to quantize that.
That's right. That's one of my points.
None of it seems to be so strong as to say that it doesn't make any sense to think of a sort of semi-classical fluid dynamics of a collection of dense collection of strings. I think what the argument says is that you can't quantize this thing.
That might be a reasonable conclusion out of this. I mean, so I'm not really saying anything about the open string context. Open string is something much more larger than this. All I'm saying is that we shouldn't be get excited by having this string-like solution at this level. So there must, I mean, it may be that there is some sense in which the closed string does come out of open string, but that probably requires a little bit more deep investigation than this.
Is this Lagrangian sufficient to see that there are E-strings for the two-brain case?
Presumably you can see that. I mean, lower dimensional D-brains are fairly easy to see.
Right, so, but you would not see in this form any duality between the things you're constructing.
Yeah, I don't think so, yeah. I mean, D-string out of unstable D2, for example, is again very singular configuration. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. But the two things are sufficiently different and behaves, I mean the fundamental string size seems to be much, much subtler than the D-brain side. Okay, that's it for today. Any more questions? Right, tension is again alpha prime because, I mean, there is an alpha prime that should be sitting in front of F, which I suppressed. And the only scale in the theory is that because the scale of the tension disappeared completely because it went away with potential. It multiplied the potential, so it cannot possibly enter. Only scale is alpha prime sitting in front of F. And if I kept that through the discussion, I would have alpha prime at the end of the day again. So it's again string, same thing.
So there is no G string?
There is no G string in this story.
What about non-commutative behaviors where some sort of violation of Lorentz invariance at some scale?
Yeah, actually, I'm very confused by that, because once upon a time, people at Chicago found a solution, classical, this flux string solution with width of this non-commutative scale, which of course vanishes as you remove non-commutativity. And it wasn't clear at the time what's that got to do with this, or, you know, it's a different thing, same thing. I mean, I'm confused as before.
Doesn't alpha prime factor out of the equation
motion of the string? Right. So over there, it will be sitting in front of.
Over there.
Yeah.
The only way you would see this tension is by being able to quantize it and know what corresponds to one string.
That's right.
Yeah.
Here, it is a completely fluid thing. So what I meant is, if you have a unit electric charge in this end, that would be alpha prime. That's all. If I knew how to quantize, of course.
But
that's right. Over there, for example, in D2 case, the statement that U1 is compact translate to the fact that phi is a period 2 pi, and that will give you unit. But I mean, doesn't that also, in some sense, require a quantizing thing?
Yeah,
yeah, it's not. Yeah. That's right.
Just a little bit
of quantum mechanics. That's right.
Okay. Let's make by hearing the statements.